It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. The concept of the myth is found in every civilization. Every civilization has its creation story, its religious heritage, and so forth. We remain fascinated, however, with the myths of ancient Greece and Rome and their gods and goddesses and various deities of all sorts. There's a new book out that gives a kind of takes the wrapping off of these myths and shows them to us perhaps as they were originally written and intended, which is quite a bit different than the mythology that most of us perhaps grew up with or learned about in elementary school. And so we're going to talk about that book today. The book is Oh My Gods, and the author, Philip Freeman, is with me this morning. He is the Qualley Professor and Chair of the Classics Department at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And the full title of the book is Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. Professor Freeman, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks very much.
Where did this book come from, assuming that it did not spring full-blown from the brow of Zeus?
No, it didn't. Well, I have been teaching classical mythology to students, college students, for 20 years or more, and I've always enjoyed it, but there has never really been a book available, I don't think, that tells the stories as they were originally written, with all of the sex and violence and madness of the ancient tales. And so I decided to write this book partially for my students, but really, I guess even more for the general public, for people to see what the original myths were really like. We all grew up reading mythology. Many of us read Edith Hamilton's wonderful book in school. Those sorts of books are very good, but they don't, I don't think, give the true picture of what the ancient myths are really like.
Well, in the true picture, holy smokes, this is just the creation story alone is a giant tale of incest, rape, patricide, matricide, fill in the blank aside. Man, there was a lot of really nasty stuff going on.
It was, and this is one reason why this Oh My Gods book, I really wrote it for grown-ups, for high school age and above, and there's a children's version of it coming out in May that takes some of that stuff out that really wouldn't be appropriate. But yes, starting with the creation story, these tales are just shocking.
As I was looking at the book, I was reminded of how sanitized the version of, for example, Grimm's fairy tales most of us grew up with compared to the original stories, which were cautionary tales and were often quite brutal. And they were warnings. You know, if you do this, this is what happens. The ogre eats you, or you end up in the oven as the witch's dinner or whatever. The versions that a lot of us got perhaps were read as bedtime stories. We're quite heavily sanitized. The same is true, apparently, of Greek mythology. There would be some obvious reasons for doing that for children. But why haven't we really looked at what the reality was of these myths? If that doesn't contradict itself until now.
I think it's I think a lot of it is that somehow mythology has been it's been decided that mythology is for children, and therefore we want to have mythological tales that are suitable for children. Where really these Greek and Roman myths were never written for children at all; they were written for grown-ups, and so I think that's probably the reason. So it's one reason I wrote this book, is I wanted to bring it out of children's literature and into the mainstream of adult stories.
Now, the mythical creatures and inhabitants of this world have made it to the silver screen in a number of iterations. As you point out, this has also been the inspiration for a number of great authors, including Shakespeare and C.S. Lewis and J.K. Rowling, just to name three. What is it about this that has translated so well into other formats culturally? Dance, theater, films, radio, television, and books. What is it about this, about these stories that, that makes them translate so well into pop culture?
Well, the thing about the classical myths is that they are timeless. The elements of the stories, sure, they all may be wearing togas or wandering around Athens, but what really makes these stories grip the human imagination, whatever century you live in, is because they deal with such constant features of human life, life and death and love and loss and suffering. That are just as real to us today as they were 2,800 years ago to Homer.
So we talk about this as Greek and Roman mythology. What are the differences between the Roman interpretation? I mean, they obviously inherited these gods and goddesses and creatures and so forth and the traditions from ancient Greece. But what are the differences between the Roman versions and the Greek versions of these stories, or are there none?
Well, there are some differences. First of all, when we talk about classical mythology, mostly, maybe 95%, we're talking about Greek mythology. And the Romans had myths of their own way back in time, but most of those have been lost or turned into historical tales, early historical tales like Romulus and Remus. But the Roman myths that we do have are different in because they emphasize devotion to the state. They read almost like Soviet propaganda in a way, that the individual should sacrifice himself or herself for the good of the state. And that is something that is very different from Greek mythology. And Greek mythology, if it has an overarching theme at all, must be that the world is just full of madness.
Do we know exactly who wrote this and where the mythology came from, where the stories of creation and so forth, who authored them of the Greeks?
Well, we do know in many cases who was the final author who took these stories and put them down in written form, but they had been around for centuries, many, many centuries before. The story of the Trojan War, for example, which was put together by Homer sometime in the 8th century BC, that story had been around for many, many centuries before Homer. It was told by oral poets, by bards who traveled around, but Homer was the one who put it all together, and the story of Odysseus as well. That we have other authors such as Hesiod who put together these myths at about the same time. And then a number of later authors as well, such as the Roman poet Ovid, who collected these stories. So most of the myths that we have were not invented by the authors who recorded them, but they were collected, sort of like Grimm's fairy tales, collected and modified in some ways to suit the particular audience that they were aiming at.
Now, when we talk about ancient Greece, we're not talking about a unified state. I mean, because you had all the city-states and so forth in Greece, and before that, people tended to live in, it was more of a tribal culture. I'm going to ask this wrong, but I'll try it anyway. How is it that we can speak of this as these are the stories of ancient Greece? Were these religious ideas common to all of the various groups, whether it was Athens or Sparta or wherever? Were these myths and traditions common to all the various cultural groups in Greece at that time?
Well, it's a great question. You're right, of course, that Greece was never a unified nation in ancient times. It was a collection of city-states, and in earlier times, a collection of kingdoms. But even though it wasn't politically unified, it was culturally unified, so that the people of Sparta worshipped the same gods as those of Athens or those of Thebes. And yet we do see differences between the different cities. They emphasize certain gods more than others. We see different versions of myths in one city that are at variance with the same myth in another city. So there was certainly a unified Greek culture, so that these stories were told all over the ancient Greek world. But there were slight differences.
Could you illustrate one or two of those?
Well, there are differences, for example, about the stories of Hercules, the different labors of Hercules. Sometimes they're different in one city versus another. Sometimes you have stories such as the goddess Demeter. You'll have some cities saying, naturally enough, that, yeah, she was born here in our city or nearby, where you will have other cities say, no, she was born up here. So you will have in stories about Zeus, about where he was born, where he was raised. So you get minor variants like that, and sometimes you get even larger ones. But it's in general, though, the stories of ancient Greece are there are varieties out there, but they were unified across the whole culture.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question about ancient Greek or Roman mythology. We have the author of the book, Oh My Gods, with us this morning. So we have the expert here, your chance to ask a question or make a comment. Maybe you have an observation, something you've learned that you'd like to share. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, good from just about anywhere. The email address, which does work everywhere, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Go there and leave a comment or a question, and I'll share it on the air. My guest is Philip Freeman. He's the author of Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. Just even a preliminary glance at the book demonstrates that there's a lot more detail here than most of us got in school. Even if we had some course that dealt with Greek or Roman mythology, there was a lot of stuff in here that I was reading or hearing about for the very first time. As you interact with your students and you teach these courses, what would you say would be the most common misconception that they come in with regarding this ancient mythology?
Well, that's a great question. Most of the students who sign up for a course in Greek mythology at my college, at Luther College, or anywhere around the country, come in having grown up watching the Disney movie Hercules, and maybe having read a book or two when they were younger. So they're shocked, once again, at just how violent and troubling some of these myths are. They're also shocked about how unfair the gods are. Many of them come from a Judeo-Christian tradition where we're taught that God is just. Of course, there's a single God, and that he is the arbitrator of justice. But the gods in the Greek world are very often not just at all. They are they're petty. They're mean. They can be nice if they're in the mood, but most of the time they're not. And so it's really troubling to deal with divinities or with a religious system where the gods are not examples for human behavior. I think that's probably the main shocking point for them.
Yeah, and that's something that really comes through in your book. I mean, when you look at the way the gods behave, they make humans look good.
Oh, yes, they do. I mean, the humans, many of the humans are much more noble. All of the young women that Zeus pursues and often rapes are much more noble in their morality than the leader of the gods is.
So what was the point then of worshiping gods like this? I mean, if the gods aren't going to be better than we are, what would have been the point of worshiping them other than fear of thunderbolts or some other bad thing happening to you if you didn't?
Well, it's a tough question. Why would the Greeks worship gods like this? And it's something we ask in class. I think one reason is that the Greeks would never have expected their gods to be moral examples. They thought of the gods as having powers. Zeus would have power over the thunder. Hera, his wife and his sister, would have power over childbirth and other matters of women. So what you would do is you would sacrifice maybe a chicken, maybe a goat, to Hera if you were a young woman who was pregnant, and you would pray for a healthy baby, you would pray for a good child. And so it was more like a business relationship in many ways than it would be as we would think of as worship. And I don't mean to downplay the idea of worship and devotion, because that was certainly there in the ancient Greek world, but there really is much more I give you something, so you give me something back sort of idea.
I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some callers who want to join us, and phone lines are full right now, but you can always use the email talk@WPR.org or find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page there and leave your comment or question for my guest, who is Philip Freeman, a quality professor and chair of the Classics Department at Luther College, and the author of the book, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, published by Simon and Schuster. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Coming up later on today on the Ideas Network, on Talk of the Nation, 2011 was another tough year for many, but things are looking up in some sectors, technology, manufacturing, and agriculture. After 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation, pockets of strength in the economy, plus a new documentary on grief and reconstruction after Japan's earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown. That's coming up after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about ancient Greek and Roman mythology with the author of a new book on the subject, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. My guest is Philip Freeman, quality professor and chair of the Classics Department at Luther College. And we have callers on the line, Professor, so let's take some of those. We'll start in West Dallas and hear what Thomas has to say. Thomas, good morning.
Yes, sir. I would like to ask Professor Freeman if Robert Graves' great work on the Greek myths, is that a reliable text of the original Greek myths, or and if not, what would you recommend some other text like Ovid's Metamorphoses or something else?
Yes, I mean, I think Robert Graves actually is a very good author. I mean, some people might disagree with parts of it, but no, I think he would be a really good source. But I would always direct people to go back to the original sources, like to Ovid. To his Metamorphoses is just a wonderful book of myths. Or to read the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey. It's just a magnificent collection. Or the Iliad, for that matter. Any of these would just be is what I would recommend to people to read.
Thomas, thanks for that question. Let's go to Lake Geneva next and hear from Jim. Jim, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to hear the conversation. It's very interesting stuff. I was curious. The Clash of the Titans was a movie that was back. I read Greek mythology when I was in high school and stuff with Zeus. I think the Clash of the Titans is kind of loosely based on Greek mythology, and that was kind of one of our comment about that. And I was also thinking mainly, I was in Rome, and I guess Rome was founded by Romulus and Remus, the legend has it. I think that's kind of mythology, I'm guessing. I'm just wondering what the comments might be about that. Might flesh that out if that's the same. I guess they were raised by wolves or something. I think that's the Roman culture thinks that. I don't know how they think nowadays, same thing. Or maybe you want to just say that. I'll just take my answers off. Yeah, I was curious about those two things.
Yeah, you're right. Clash of the Titans, I think it was back in the 50s, was it early 60s? It was the original movie. Recently, a remake has been done. Wrath of the Titans, I think, is coming out just in a couple of weeks. Those are very loosely based on classical myth, but they're fun to watch. You're right about Romulus and Remus. That is the origin myth of Greece and Rome, that they were founded by these two twins who were abandoned, very much like Moses was. The Romulus and Remus were abandoned and suckled by a wolf, wolf who rescued them, and these boys went on to found the city of Rome. So the Romans like to look back on their founders as these especially tough young men who were nursed by a wolf.
And thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. Room now for you if you'd like to call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. talk@WPR.org also works, and you can find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page and leave a comment or question there. We have an email from Tess in Appleton. From Greek and Roman mythology, particularly the later tragic dramas with roots in mythology, I've taken lessons and questions that have served me very well in life. I've learned about the importance of balancing chaos and order from the Bacchae, the potential tragedy that can come from vastly different philosophical approaches to civilization from Ajax, and the stark fact that one always has a choice in how one acts from the Orestia. Professor?
Yes, I mean, I think that Tess is right. There's so much
I mean, these are wonderful stories. They're great to read. They're entertaining. But there's so much we can take from them about living our own life. And the reference to the Bacchae is right. It's a story of Dionysus, the god of wine, who comes to town and teaches the people that they have to let go of being so uptight sometimes. And it's a great story. It's not a story about getting drunk as much as it is about finding balance in your life. And I think that would be just one of the main lessons that the Greeks would like to teach. But there are so many more lessons about love and loss and everything else in these myths that people can apply to their own lives.
These myths were really in a way, they were the Greek attempt to make sense out of the world around them, were they not?
They were. And I think the Greeks, in many ways, are more honest when they say the moral of the story is that sometimes things just don't make sense, and we have to learn to live with it.
We start, and again, I keep coming back to this, but it's so fascinating because you compare all of the different creation stories of various cultures. There are often similarities and, of course, great differences as well, but it all starts with chaos. And I was wondering if you had some insights for us on why it starts with chaos, where that idea comes from.
I think that in a lot of different stories, creation stories around the world, what you have is not a creation out of nothing, but you have disorder. And creation is an act of bringing the elements that are already there into order, and that's what happens in the Greek myth. The first line of the first chapter of this book is, in the beginning there was chaos, and chaos was this great bottomless chasm full of all these unformed elements, and it's different from the story in Genesis. Somehow this all comes together, and there's no God who makes it happen. It just seems to happen on its own. But we get stories like this in Norse mythology, in various creation myths all around the world. So it's an idea of bringing order to chaos, I think, that lies behind most of them.
We have some more callers on the line. Let's go to Mabel, Minnesota, and hear from Michelle. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, Professor. I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell talks about it.
Yes, Joseph Campbell was just a wonderful teacher, a wonderful collector and interpreter of mythology, and he talks about the journey of the hero. It's maybe best known to people in Star Wars films, because George Lucas was also a big fan. But we see this in Greek mythology about the young man, usually a young man, sometimes a woman, but a young man who has a difficult childhood, goes through all sorts of different struggles, has to go on a great journey, proves himself, resist temptation. It's a story. It's a theme that we get in so many different classical stories, and it's just wonderful about sometimes about going down into the realm of the dead or some equivalent of it, coming back, facing temptation. Yeah, it's a marvelous a tool, I think, for looking at myth, classical and otherwise.
Thank you,
Michelle. Thanks for the call, Michelle. Appreciate it. Let's go. Hang on. Let's. Everybody's got their favorite, I think, of people who've read the stories and the myths of ancient Greece and Rome. Probably everybody has their favorite story. And I was wondering, Professor, if you would share which of the stories of ancient Greece and Rome would be your personal favorite.
Oh, that's an unfair question. There's so many good ones. But let's see. I think probably my favorite would have to be the story of Odysseus. The story of this man who is coming back from the Trojan War. He fights there for 10 years. He's left behind his young wife and baby son, and he's trying to make his way back home, and it takes him 20 years to get there, so that by the time he reaches home, his son is grown up, and he goes through all sorts of difficulties, and talk about, you know, applying myth to life. He goes through difficulties about facing Cyclops and whirlpools and Scylla and Charybdis and monsters. but he also faces these other temptations, obstacles on his way home, where he is offered eternal life, even if he will stay with this beautiful goddess. And he says to her, you know, this is the goddess, this is a great gift that you are offering me, but I would much rather go home and die with my Penelope than to live forever with you. And so it's just a great story, and in the end he finally does make it home, and it's difficult, even once he gets home, to try to reclaim his life, but it's a great metaphor, I think, for the lives of all of us.
See, my favorite was always Jason and the Argonauts. David in La Crosse joins us next. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good morning, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I have... We're doing a production of Hippolytus here at Viterbo University in La Crosse. It plays a little advertisement. It plays 2 weekends in April, the last 2 weekends. But I've done Greek tragedies, directed in London and Denmark, and I know that there's a production going on right now in China. So obviously these are very universal. Not only are they old, but they translate into all cultures and all the rest of it. And this present production of ours, Hippolytus, is really between a battle between two extremes, the Aphrodite and Artemis, the goddess of passion and romance and whatever, and the goddess of innocence and virginity and whatever. And it's much like the battle between two extremes that we are having here today in our politics, with, of course, the ordinary person caught and damaged in the middle. I was wondering if you had any comments about that.
No, you're right, of course, Hippolytus, a great story, this young man who wants nothing to do with love, nothing to do with sex, and the consequences that costs him. And I think, you're right, this is, again, the theme of balance that the Greeks were always talking about. You know, there's a place for Aphrodite in your life, there's a place for Artemis, and you have to find that place in between. The extremes, whether it's Aphrodite and Artemis or liberalism and conservatism, the whole classical world, not just mythology, but is about finding that middle path. I think, again, it's a story that we need to hear.
And thanks a lot for that call, David. Appreciate it. And I hope a lot of people go and see your play. Hugh in Milwaukee, you'll be next. Hugh, good morning.
Hi. You talk about chaos and the worldview that they, the world, the gods are mad and insane and jealous and so forth. And yet, it's the ancient world that provided so much of science and scientific theory and scientific, even notions of the size of the Earth and the planets and so forth that would be used for a millennium. I would suggest. What do you think of the movie Agora? What do you think of the movie Troy? And what do you think of Freud as far as reinvigorating the myths into the 20th century?
Oh, big questions. Agora was a wonderful movie about this woman philosopher in Alexandria and her struggles with the militant Christians of the time about reason versus chaos. Again, I think you're right. I love the movie. I thought it was great. Troy was fun. I wouldn't say that it was particularly faithful to Homer, but it was. I enjoyed it. I show it in my classes just because it's a good starting point for talking about the myths. And Freud, Freud was very well read in mythology, and so when he looks at Oedipus and other stories and sees application of that to modern psychological principles, I think he's really hit on something that the Greeks knew about these ideas long before we ever thought of them. So, I think that's great.
Hugh, thanks for the call. Let's hear from Betty next. Betty, good morning.
Good morning. I'm on a cell phone, so if I cut out, why don't take offense.
Okay, go ahead.
Years ago, I read something, and I remember it forever, that the, and I want to preface this by saying that I am a Christian, and I do accept the Bible as written, but that's, I'm not evangelical, it's just the deals, the people that wrote it said that due to the way the primitive people in those days thought of things, and in order to get them to accept the Jesus as a God, I mean, to sit with God and there was a God, that the Bible, and especially the New Testament, had to be written sort of in that, I don't know, what would you want to say, vernacular, that it kind of related to the mythical things that people believed in.
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting idea. The New Testament, the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, none of these sacred texts were written in a vacuum at all. So the authors of the New Testament books, Paul especially, very well-educated man, knew all about these myths. And so I think that it's normal for those authors to draw on the culture in which they live in order to get their point across. I don't think there's anything unchristian at all about that. I mean, you look at Paul and his speech in the book of Acts, where he's in front of the Areopagus Council in Athens, and how he quotes Greek playwrights. He talks about an unknown God. So I think that the early Christian authors were very much aware of this classical tradition, and they did play on it. They had to. It was the only way to get their message across to the people of the time.
Beth, thanks for that call. Here's an email from Elizabeth in Milwaukee who writes, I'm curious whether the ancient Greeks were familiar with myths from other contemporary cultures in Europe, the Middle East, or Africa. If so, did myths from those cultures have any influence on the Greek myths?
Oh, yes, indeed they did. The Greeks were very aware of, especially myths to the East, myths from the Near East, myths from Egypt. We know that there had been contact between Greece and Egypt for centuries before Homer started recording myths. So we see a lot of elements of Near Eastern Egyptian mythology in Greek mythology. The creation stories are a good example. We have these generational battles that take place in the Greek creation stories. But centuries earlier, we have very similar texts going on in Mesopotamia, in the Hittite world. So the Greeks were definitely influenced from Asia, Africa, and they also knew about myths later on, at least. They knew about myths to the West, such as Celtic mythology, German stories, but mostly it was stories from the Near East and Africa that had the biggest influence on the Greeks.
And thanks for that email, Elizabeth. Room for you if you'd like to call and ask your question or make a comment. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Again, the phone number, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. One of the themes in mythology is the idea of lovers, and they were almost always, I guess we could say, star-crossed. There was an element of tragedy in pretty much every love story that comes out of mythology, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about an example that you use in your book of lovers about Narcissus and Echo.
Yes, it's a great story. Narcissus and Echo, of course, it's the story of the origin of the word narcissism. Narcissus was a young man, like Hippolytus we talked about earlier, who wanted nothing to do with love and sex. And so he was cursed by one of the gods who said that he would never know happiness and that he would basically fall in love with himself. So what happened was that Narcissus one time looked into a pool and saw his reflection, and he kept staring at his reflection, and he didn't eat and he didn't drink, and he wasted away and eventually died staring at his own image, which is again another lesson I think that all of us could learn.
And that was, you know, I mean, that's just one of the stories, but I mean, this is a common theme. There's people fall in love, but they are doomed almost from the start tripped up by some vengeful or petty or jealous god or demigod. I mean, this entire world is a real mess emotionally and psychologically.
Well, it is. You look at stories. I mean, you hardly ever have the ending of a Greek love story. They lived happily ever after. That just doesn't happen very much. Usually, they both one or both of them end up dead, and they end up having a short and tragic life. You take Pyramus and Thisbe, the story of these star-crossed lovers, who are the basis for Romeo and Juliet. Shakespeare borrowed this story. They fell in love with each other. They agreed to meet. One of them is thought to have been killed by a lion, so one of the lovers kills himself, finds out later it wasn't true. The girl comes in, she kills herself. There's just this terrible, tragic element, it seems, in all of these Greek love stories.
800-642-1234. We've got some callers on the line. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more calls and questions for my guest, Philip Freeman, who is the author of Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's just about 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller's in after 11. Days are getting longer and the sun is getting stronger. Larry Mueller finds out at 11 what that means for taking care of our skin. This hour we're talking about Greek and Roman mythology. There's a new book out about this, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, by Philip Freeman, quality professor and chair of the Classics Department at Luther College. And we have Professor Freeman on the line with us. And we also have Carol from Muskoda. Carol, good morning. And thanks so much for joining us.
Yes. Now, given that the behavior of the gods is so much like a projection of human nature and human behavior, I'm wondering what your notion and opinion are of the possibility that these Greeks took their stories very metaphorically. They were intended metaphorically, and they were taken largely metaphorically as opposed to literally. And an example of that would be today the biblical stories that many consider to be mythical are were in fact intended to be perhaps metaphorical, but now they've become literal to many people. And I'm wondering if you think some kind of process like that occurred and how many people took them metaphorically.
Yes, I think you're right. I think the Greeks from the beginning took their myths metaphorically. That when we have a creation story, I don't think many people would have gotten upset if somebody said, no, that's not how it really happened. I don't think they, at least in general, ever intended these stories to be taken literally. They were all stories that tried to represent the condition of the world, the human condition. So I don't think there would have been a big battle between liberals and fundamentalists in the ancient Greek world about these tales.
And Carol, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Rosanna in Kenosha. Rosanna, good morning, and thanks for being with us today.
Morning, and this is so very wonderful. I was born and raised in the southern part of Italy, in the town of Locri e Pisafiri. Pisafiri in Greek means surrounded by the zephyr winds. And Locri is just 1 hour away from Scylla, which is the place where Ulysses had the shipwreckage. I did translate the Odyssey from Greek into Italian when I was a student there. And right now, it's my sister is a professor of Latin and Greek. She's doing her own version of the translation of the Odyssey because she didn't think that many of the others were so accurate. Anyway, my favorite spot, and I don't know if professor would like to elaborate, is the part where Ulysses was in the woods, and he was running the possibility and the probability of dying of being cold and covering himself with the leaves or just being attacked by animals. I use that every day. I'm a physician, and I think about him all the time and how smart he was and how wonderful he was to listen to that. And I was wondering, I've they organize, or has there been any tours of this part of the country where Ulysses was? Right now I'm in the process of getting ready for a trip to Turkey, and I will be visiting Troy. And I'm very excited about that. That's my own comment, and I will be curious to see the comment of the professor. Thank you very much.
Yes, southern Italy, by the way, was very much a part of the Greek world back in classical times. Sicily, southern Italy, Naples, all of that area features prominently in Greek mythology, such as the story of Ulysses, that's the Roman name for Odysseus. Yes, it's definitely a place to go, absolutely essential part of the ancient Greek world. But there are tours that go over to southern Italy, especially that go to Greece itself. They go to Troy. I was in Troy just a couple of years ago. Wonderful place. I recommend to anybody. And even though many of these stories might be metaphorical, maybe there wasn't. They didn't exactly happen as they're recorded. Still, the opportunity to stand on the ruins of Troy, or to stand on the Athenian Acropolis, or to sail between the island of Sicily and Italy, where the whirlpool and monster of Scylla and Charybdis allegedly was. It's just, it's so exciting to actually do it. So I recommend to anybody, if you have the chance, go over, take a tour, travel around, and see these sites. It really makes the myths come alive.
Rosanna, thank you very, very much for your call. Let's go to Merrill next and hear from Paul. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. I have a book in front of me called Violence Unveiled by Gil Bailey, who was and is a student of René Girard, of a French religious anthropologist. And I'm open to page 33 in Violence Unveiled, where Gil Bailey kind of defines his understanding of myth, which is, in his words, to close or keep secret. And he goes on to talk about myth as being an enchanting story of founding violence. And from there, he goes on to talk about the contrast between myth and truth, in the sense of truth shedding light on the enchanting story of founding violence that myth provides. And I'm wondering if you have any comments on Gil Bailey or the work of René Girard.
Well, I haven't read the Bailey book, Violence Unveiled. I've certainly read a good bit about the mythological theory. There are an awful lot of different ways of looking at myths, a lot of different theories. People will use, there's so many, feminist criticism, construction. There's just so many ways of looking at myth to try to understand what they really mean. It's something we talk about in class, about different methods of interpretation, Jungian interpretation, Freudian interpretation. And I think all of them, actually, in many ways, are valid. They all have some insight to give us. I think people maybe get in trouble when they have one particular point of view from looking at myth, and they're not willing to explore a different area. But I think all of these different interpretations have something to offer.
Thanks for the call, Paul. And let's go to Madison next. Anne, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. A Duke anthropologist named Weston LaBarre wrote at least one book on the origin of the gods, and his theory was that in ancient times, man didn't know how to control the natural elements. You know, they were subject to earthquakes and tornadoes and fire and floods and drought and all these forces they had absolutely no defenses against. And so they invented the gods out of fear, and they, you know, each one of them personified, or often personified, a different force, and they felt they had to appease the gods. So, you know, even the Old Testament God, you know, with a capital G, is a pretty vengeful, pretty vengeful guy. And I thought that was kind of an interesting theory of the gods, the idea that people should be nice to each other and everything is definitely not embodied in these sort of supernatural, you know, embodiments of the natural forces.
I think you're right. The Greeks were much more lived much closer to the earth than most of us. They were almost all farmers, and they depended for their very lives on the forces of nature and getting enough rain at the right time, on not having too early a frost. And so naturally, they would appeal to whatever forces they either that they believed existed to help them just to get through life. It was a struggle. And so I think that there is something to the idea that the Greeks invented these gods as a way to try to get some control over their life. And we all do this in some sense, invent our own, I hate to use the word gods, but invent a struggle to try to get some control over the uncontrollable forces of our lives. And so I think the Greeks were just like anybody else in this.
Anne, thanks for the call. Time for one or two more calls if you get in right away at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I want to talk a little bit about the Romans again and go back to this, because one of the things I found was very curious is that the Romans claim ancestry from the Trojans, not the Greeks, in terms of their history and philosophy and so forth. Why was that?
Yeah, it's interesting that the Romans, this powerful empire, claimed ancestry from the losers of the Trojan War. I think one reason is that the Romans, although they admired the Greeks, they were always very suspicious of them. They were thought of as shifty and a little too crafty for the good, upstanding Romans. But the Trojans, they admired. They admired Hector in the story of the Trojan War. And so they wanted to tie themselves in to the larger Greek mythological world. And so they chose as their ancestors one of the Trojans, Aeneas, who sails to Italy. And they actually had more than one creation, more than one origin story, but that is the one that that survives as most prominent anyway.
Okay, we have some more callers. Let's go to George in Columbus next.
Yes, hello. Am I on?
Yeah, go ahead, George. Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious, how did these myths get transferred or maintained to the people? Was there preaching going on? Who told these stories? How did they get around?
I think they would have been told in different ways. I don't think there would have been many sermons like we think of today, but there were professional storytellers, professional bards who traveled around and told stories at weddings and at festivals, and people would have come and heard these stories certainly at those festivals and contests. These stories would have been repeated around the fireside from mother or father to their children. So it was, I think, largely an oral sort of transmission, but they were written down, and people, at least later on in classical times, would have read all of these stories. Plato would have read Homer. Julius Caesar would have read all of these. And so it was a mixture, really, I think, of oral and written transmission.
George, thanks for the call. Here's an email. Mark emails, did the common Greek person see these myths as literally true? Anyone looking at the summit of Mount Olympus should be able to guess that no one could live on top of the mountain. Did they have a superstitious understanding of the gods as if they might meet one walking around in their neighborhood?
Well, you know, like we were talking about before, I think the Greeks thought of these as metaphor to a great extent, but I do think that the Greeks believed in their gods. If you look at Mount Olympus, if it's not too cloudy, the mountain's very often covered with clouds, it's certainly not a place anybody would want to live. But did the Greeks believe in their gods literally, that they did the things in the stories? Maybe not quite, but did they believe in that the gods in some form really were a power in the universe? Yes, I think they probably did.
What would be the one big takeaway that you would want people to have from your book? What would be the most important idea that you're putting out there?
I would like people to take away that these are wonderful stories that are great entertainment, and they are in their origin sometimes quite violent, but still wonderfully appealing, and that they have something to teach us today about how to live our own lives.
Well, we certainly could learn how not to live them by looking at the examples set down, and I'm wondering if that wasn't one of the purposes of writing these myths.
Oh, yeah. There are plenty of them are cautionary tales, with the theme of many of them being don't mess around with the gods. So, yeah, you can certainly learn a lot of things about how not to live your life as well.
And we only have about a minute left. I don't want to get too much into detail, but, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here, including the origin of the Milky Way. And if you could quickly describe that, because I think it's a fascinating story.
Yes, Hercules, or Heracles in the Greek, nurses or tries to nurse from Hera's breasts. And Hera doesn't realize, actually, it's Hercules because she didn't like him very much. And he bites her, and her milk spews across the sky, and that forms the Milky Way.
And I think that's a good place for us to leave it. So when you look at the stars tonight and see the Milky Way, now you'll know where they came from, according to the Greeks. Professor, thank you very much. It's been an interesting hour. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And the name of the book, again, is Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, published by Simon & Schuster. And Philip Freeman is a quality professor and chair of the Classics Department at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and on-air production by Cynthia Schuster. Thank you, both of you, for helping me with another hour of programming.